It's Friday, so we get to wrap up the 5 days gone by. Some corporate news and an economic indicator on the program today as well. And then, weddings, because it's Friday. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Friday, May the 24th. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Volatile might be a word one could use to describe this week in the American and global economies. Yes, the markets, sure, but also trade and the all-important politics of this economy and the global one as well, given Brexit. Catherine Rampell is here with some other words one might use. She's with The Washington Post. Neela Richardson is here, too. She's actually here, by the way, in the studio with me in L.A. She's at Edward Jones. Hey, everybody.
Hi, Kai.
Hey.
Hey, Kai.
So, Catherine, let me start with you and ask you, speaking of words and volatile, here we have had a week where China trade keeps going south, yet the Mexican and Canadian tariffs, or our tariffs, rather, on Canada and Mexico, steel and aluminum, have been lifted. Infrastructure week blew up over the politics of this economy. Should we just stop saying words like volatile and uncertainty and just accept this as the new normal?
Just because it's the new normal doesn't mean that we shouldn't describe it accurately.
Yes, touche.
Is sort of how I would come down on this. Look, there is a lot of volatility, some of which is of our president's own making, much of which I would argue is of our president's own making, like in the case of lifting the Mexican and Canadian, or rather the steel and aluminum tariffs on Mexican and Canadian products. I don't know that the president gets to commit arson and then take credit for dousing the fire. But look, markets are going to be listening for any indication that things will settle down, and it just doesn't seem like it's in the offing.
Neela, with the caveat, which is required on this program, that the stock market is not the economy but is perhaps adjacent, the market has gone basically sideways for 18 months in the face of all this chaos, I think we should say. Is it possible that the market not reacting badly is letting the president keep going on his trade policies?
Well, first of all, I would have to say that volatility and uncertainty is not new. It's part of investing. Right. It's part of Wall Street. Markets go up and down. And it's like the president has a bag of treats, right? When things get too pessimistic on Wall Street, he just lays out a little treat.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
He'll eliminate the Canadian steel tariffs and the markets get calm again. It's a nice bag of tricks. But, you know, this negotiation was never going to be short. The markets overreacted in its optimism. It was always going to be a long negotiation because it's over big things, and big things are complicated. And I think the market is finally adjusting to the complication of a U.S.-China trade deal. That's uncertainty and volatility in the short term. In the long run, it may make a bit of difference in terms of the future of economic growth and global growth.
Well, so, Catherine, let's go with that global growth theme. We have now what looks like in the U.K., with Prime Minister May leaving first week of June-ish, and Boris Johnson, the former foreign minister, and a hard Brexiteer, the favorite to take over. There is that added now element of, here's that word again, uncertainty in the global economy.
Yeah, look, I think the best hope, if you're a Brit right now, is that Johnson will realize that it's easy to talk tough, or Johnson or whoever takes over, right? That it's easy to talk tough until you're in the job, and then you look around and you say, oh no, actually, it would be disastrous if we had, for example, a no-deal Brexit, which resulted in, you know, food shortages, medicine shortages, maybe no flights coming in or out of, or going back and forth between the continent and the UK. So I think you just have to hope that reason will at some point prevail, although the track record thus far does not maybe give a whole lot of reason for hope.
Well,
Per se. But yeah, I mean, as long as this uncertainty about who the leader is, what strategy he or she will pursue continues, and how much wiggle room they even have to renegotiate this deal, it's going to be very rough on both businesses and consumers.
Okay, Neela, roll this into one big ball for me, right? Because you got Brexit over there, and as Catherine said, who knows what's going to happen. Over here, the indications are, and there were reports out this morning, that people are notching down their forecast for second quarter gross domestic product, that is economic growth, to something just above 1%, which is down a bunch from the 3.2% that we're dealing with now. What does one make of an uncertain future in the global economy and also real now signs of weakening here?
When there's a lot of balls in the air, it's best to focus on the court. And the court's pretty good if you look at economic fundamentals, right? We have a pretty strong, tight labor market, and we have a very strong consumer. Debt is at all-time lows when you talk about household debt. So the fundamentals of the economic game are still right. good. But there is a lot of uncertainty. We never expected 3% growth that we saw in the first quarter would hold through the rest of the year. We always thought that growth would slow. Now it's slowing a little bit more quickly than anyone expected. But that slower growth doesn't mean that markets and a good economy can't prevail in the end.
You sound positive.
I am positive because I look at fundamentals. I don't pay attention to political uncertainty a lot. I look at the jobs market. I look at business investment. I look at first quarter earnings. So I look at things that sustain themselves through tweets. And those things tend to be pretty solid right now.
Fair enough. Catherine Rampell, you get the last word on the next quarter in this economy and what we ought to be looking at.
I think Neil is right that the fundamentals still look pretty good. But that said, I don't think we should ignore all of these political risks mm-hmm. that are coming down the pike, not only from Europe and Brexit, of course, but you also have a budget and debt ceiling fight coming up. You also have the uncertainty related to the trade war. And look, you know, there's this concept in economics of sunspots, right, that you can have like sort of a synchronized change in expectations, a crisis right. of confidence unrelated to what the fundamentals are because there is all of this, right. Accumulation of uncertainty and risk out there. So I don't think a recession is my baseline scenario, but I would expect a slowdown.
Catherine Rampell at The Washington Post, Neil Richardson at Edward Jones. She was in studio with me here in L.A., which was a treat. Thanks, you two.
Thank you, Kai.
Thanks, Kai.
Have a nice weekend, everybody. On Wall Street today, there was some buying, actually, as traders headed into the three-day weekend. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There was a decidedly blah piece of economic news from the Commerce Department today, talking big picture. Orders for durable goods, that is big, expensive stuff meant to last a while, airplanes, household appliances, business machinery, those kinds of things, those orders fell more than 2% last month. You dig in a little bit, commercial airplane orders were way down. Hello, Boeing 737 MAX. But the weakness really was widespread, and it comes on top of some other recent dreary data points for U.S. manufacturing. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman puts it all into context.
This report on durable goods orders is pretty weak, says Andrew Hunter at Capital Economics. And he points out it's for April, before the recent escalation of tensions with China over tariffs and trade.
Given the significant uncertainty for many firms that will be caused by that, I think that's potentially reason to expect further weakness.
The troubles of one company, Boeing, account for a sizable chunk of the recent slowdown in durable goods. As long as the company's top-selling 737 MAX jets aren't flying, airlines aren't ordering any more. It could be early next year before global aviation officials approve Boeing's safety fixes and lift the worldwide grounding. Other big U.S. exporters are being hurt by a slowdown in major economies around the world. Analyst Jim Corridor at CFRA Research says business leaders may be wary of making big investments in new machinery or facilities right now, faced with
uncertainty. What's going to happen with the trade war? Is the U.S. going to get involved in more geopolitical issues around the world? U.S. government embroiled in scandals and unable to get anything done in Congress?
For some manufacturers, the problem right now is a tight labor market. Darlene Miller at Permac Industries outside Minneapolis says her business, making components for aerospace and medical equipment, is up significantly from last year.
Our only problem is finding the talent we need.
She says skilled manufacturing workers have been in short supply for years. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
President Trump is on his way to Tokyo, as you might have heard. They're packing his schedule pretty good over there, meeting the new emperor, a sumo tournament as well, and oh yeah, some meetings with Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. Front and center on their agenda, as it so very often is these days, trade. There will be the usual items, better access to Japanese agriculture markets for one thing. Cars are going to come up as well, because last week, President Trump said auto imports are a threat to U.S. national security, and he started a 180-day countdown after which he could impose tariffs if negotiations with Japan and the Europeans don't pan out. So, what is he looking for from Japan on this, and what does it have to give? Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson digs into that one.
One idea is for Japanese automakers to make more cars in the U.S. Mireya Solis is with the Brookings Institution.
And that's, I think, the central demand at the heart of what the Trump administration wants from Japan.
But Japanese automakers counter, they already have big investments here, making one-third of all vehicles produced in the U.S.
And, you know, automation is a very important driver in the auto industry, so it's not even clear that new investments would just easily translate into major job creation.
It's also unclear how that would address the White House's national security concerns. When it comes to selling more American cars in Japan,
Japan has zero tariff on imported vehicles.
Christian Cicek with the Center for Automotive Research says Japan could lower its so-called non-tariff barriers, like harmonizing its safety regulations with ours. But American firms just don't make the kind of cars Japanese consumers want to buy.
There's a market for luxury vehicles, and we make some nice luxury vehicles, but we don't make them in right-hand drive, so they're not popular. And the rest of the market is looking at these very small micro cars that we don't make at all.
Another idea, Japan could agree to limit the number of cars it sells to the U.S. Scott Seaman is with Eurasia Group.
The Japanese government and Japanese automakers, parts makers, have been very clear that they are completely unwilling to accept any type of managed trade arrangement, caps, quotas, that sort of thing.
But that may be where talks end up, because Seaman says if the choice is between quotas and tariffs, Japan would probably prefer quotas. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Bloomberg had the news this week that Amazon is working on a wearable device that would read human emotions, the idea being that it could help detect mental health problems. Also this week, there was the news that Comcast is getting ready to introduce in-home technology to identify potential health problems elderly Americans might be having. Falls, for instance, or an unusual number of trips to the bathroom. Apple and Google and Microsoft are investing in this space as well, because tech companies moving into healthcare devices and services? Oh, it's a thing. Marketplace's Andy Euler explains.
The healthcare industry makes up about one-sixth of the U.S. economy, so of course the likes of Jeff Bezos and Tim Cook would like a bigger slice.
Tech industry can smell blood in the water.
Jeff Becker is a healthcare analyst at Forrester. He says big tech knows that a lot of Americans are unhappy with the quality of their healthcare and how much they're spending. People are looking for alternatives.
There's a real problem to solve, and that's just a magnet to big business moving in to try to stake a claim.
But for companies like Amazon, Apple, and Comcast that want to sell us devices that monitor our pulse, detect when we fall, or when we're just bummed out, there are risks. And that comes down to how they treat our very personal health data. Bill Evans is managing director of Rock Health, a research and investment firm.
Some of the big institutions in healthcare are still highly trusted, but the least trusted entities are tech companies right now.
So if a tech company were to accidentally or intentionally reveal healthcare data that it got through your heartbeat monitoring wristband, that would be an even bigger trust issue. Joe Guagliardo is a technology lawyer with Pepper Hamilton. He says as more companies not really known for healthcare move into the space, regulation is going to have to catch up with disruptive technology.
It's not just a matter of having providers or consumers adopt the technology. In some cases, it's about rethinking, completely rethinking existing processes.
He says the rapid development of new tech-focused healthcare products is likely to force the issue of regulating access to healthcare data sooner rather than later. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Coming up,
you see it over and over. You see the bachelorette party in Palm Springs or in Nashville or whatever, and you think, I want that.
Fine, but it's going to cost your guests, you know. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 95 points today, 0.3%, 25,585. The NASDAQ rose 8 points, about 0.1%, 76.37. The S&P 500 up 3 points, about 0.1%, 28.26. For the week, the Dow dropped more than 0.2%. The NASDAQ shed more than 2.25%. The S&P 500 down about 0.1%. There were some reports out today that Snapchat might be in talks with big music labels to figure out a way for users to add music to their posts. Parent company Snap whistled up almost 4%. Other social media stocks also rose. Twitter gained nearly 0.6%. Facebook up 0.1%. Bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 2.32%. You're listening to Marketplace. Hey, everybody, it's Kai. I want you to listen to the latest Make Me Smart. This week, we are talking about what happens when companies get big, really big, too big, some would say. The antitrust lens has been pointed at Amazon and Google, and also, recently, Facebook, by one of its co-founders, Chris Hughes. But what if tech companies are keeping prices low for consumers? Isn't that a good thing?
To say that consumer harm can only be proved through prices, I think is just crazy.
Make Me Smart. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
And now a word from our sponsors at Betterment. Do you want your money to dream big? Do you want your money to be a total self-starter? Are you annoyed that your money doesn't work hard enough? Don't worry. Betterment is here to help. Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Their automated technology is built to help maximize returns. Meaning, when you invest with Betterment, your money can auto-adjust as you get closer to your goal. Rebalance if your portfolio gets too far out of line, and your dividends are automatically reinvested. That can increase the potential for compound returns. In other words, your money is breaking a sweat while you can be breaking bread. You'll never picture your money the same way again. Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. I saw this today from the European Council on Foreign Relations, and I thought it might be useful as a way to set up our next story. It was a survey by country of people from EU countries asking a whole bunch of questions, including whether people thought it was likely that the EU would fall apart in 10 to 20 years. In every country in the EU except Spain, a majority of people said that was realistic, including 58% of the people in France. And that gets us to this. Elections for the European Parliament are this weekend and have been described as a battle for the soul of the European Union. Essentially, more union or less, the economic consequences of which are enormous. Here's Marketplace's Stephen Beard.
Make no mistake, says veteran French political analyst Dominique Moisy, this vote is the most critical in the history of the European Parliament.
What is at stake, fundamentally, is the survival of the European Union project. Are we going to break it or to keep it?
Donald Trump's arrival in the White House, he says, along with the inexorable rise of China, make a united Europe more necessary than ever.
There is less America in the world and much more China, and there should be more Europe.
And no one is more committed to more Europe than Emmanuel Macron. They played the European anthem, not the French one, to celebrate Macron's victory in the French presidential election 2 years ago.
It had been years since a main national politician in Western Europe had run an election on an openly and admittedly and proudly pro-European message.
That's Alexandra Holroyd, a French lawmaker from Macron's party, En Marche. As president, Macron has cast himself as the saviour of Europe. He's called for a joint EU military force, a common defence budget, and a finance minister for the whole eurozone.
More cooperation between member states of the European Union are likely to ensure what the European Union has achieved, which is peace, and further prosperity and cooperation in all different kinds of fields where we need to be together.
The message from the main rival party in these European elections couldn't be more different.
Vive la liberté! Vive la belle Europe des nations! Vive la République! Et vive la France!
Long live liberty! Long live a wonderful Europe of nation states! Long live France! Shouts Marine Le Pen, head of the right-wing National Rally. The party's chief spokesman is Laurent Jacobelli.
We want the nations to be back again. We want to choose if we want or not
welcome migrants in France. We want to give the priority of employment for French companies and French people.
In other words, he says, we don't want a European Union, we want a European alliance.
Each country has to remain independent for the way it wants to rule its economics.
But given Britain's fiasco over Brexit, his party is definitely not calling for Frexit.
We don't have to break everything. We'll change everything from inside.
With the help of other Eurosceptic parties that are likely to do well in the elections in at least seven other member states, including Italy and Germany. If Le Pen's party beats Macron's, says lawmaker Alexandra Holroyd, it'll deal a very heavy blow to the Union.
Because France is not any other European country. It is a founding member of the European Union. And the signal that would be sent across borders would be absolutely catastrophic.
The big fear is voter apathy. When Dominic Moisy met a group of young French students a week ago, they seemed more interested in the final episode of the Game of Thrones.
The fate of the kingdom of Westeros seems much more important in their head than the fate of the European Union project.
An ominous sign for the EU. To borrow a phrase, winter is coming. At the European Desk, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
~75% of weddings happen in the May to October timeframe. That's according to the wedding website The Knot. So, wedding season is now officially upon us. The Knot also reports that couples now spend, on average, nearly $34,000 on their weddings. And it's not just weddings, actually. The ceremonies themselves getting pricier. It's everything leading up to them. The bridal shower, the bachelor or bachelorette party, the trying on the wedding dress, brunch. They have all become more elaborate and more expensive. And that is putting pressure on wedding guests, as Marketplace's Marielle Segarra reports.
Every time Samantha Schreiber opens her pantry, she's hit with beautiful memories of a destination bachelorette party she organized for a friend last year in California. No, actually, she's hit with a bunch of pink paper straws that say yay on them. She bought them to match the party's rose gold theme.
I have a lot left. They fall out of my pantry every time.
Schreiber's L.A. apartment is home to a collection of swag from various wedding events. The wine tumbler inscribed with her name, the beer koozies, and the T-shirts, which she keeps in a plastic bin under her bed.
Like, again, oh yeah, here's one, another one. So this is a V-neck that we wore in Vegas. And the back says, Claire's final fling before the ring.
Schreiber, who's 33, has been to seven destination bachelorette parties in places like Vegas, Nashville, and San Diego. With airfare, the hotel, meals, and everything else, these parties can be pricey. The one in California costs her more than $1,000, which is about twice the national average, according to The Knot.
You can't say, oh, I don't want to go to that restaurant, it's too expensive, or like, oh, let's not all get wine or get pitchers of beer.
For a lot of couples, a wedding isn't just a wedding anymore. It's become a marathon of elaborate events that goes on for months. Events that can be hard to resist. Meg Keen is editor-in-chief of the wedding planning website, A Practical Wedding.
The wedding industry markets in regret. It's the idea that if you don't buy it, if you don't spend the money for it, you will regret it later. And it's very effective.
Especially in the age of Instagram and Pinterest, where you can find endless ideas for bridal shower themes like mermaids or a Great Gatsby lawn party, or for bachelor party gift bags filled with cigars and mini bottles of Jack Daniels. And you see photos of a bride getting her moment in the sun, standing on a yacht surrounded by friends in matching bride squad bathing suits who are gazing at her adoringly.
You see it over and over. You see the bachelorette party in Palm Springs or in Nashville or whatever. And you think, I want that. And that's normal.
In real life, these parties are often less glamorous. Erin Brennan lives in Fort Lauderdale. At a bachelorette party she went to last year, the group decided to charter a boat for the day. It cost more than $400.
And then the day that we all came down for the party, there was a tropical storm. So we couldn't even go on the beach. We couldn't go on the water. Couldn't do anything.
The boat was non-refundable. The group of nine women also got a suite at the W Hotel, but they had to share beds. Brennan says she went to 6 weddings last year and spent about $10,000 on all the events.
I mean, we're all young. We're all like in our early 30s, late 20s. We're not like rolling in the dough.
So why not just say no? Lauren Kay is executive editor of The Knot, and she says you can. Say you're invited to your friend's bridal shower and destination bachelorette party.
I can call the bride and say, listen, you know how much I love you. You know how excited I am for you in this wedding. I can't wait to celebrate you. Unfortunately, I can't attend both of these events.
Easy enough, in theory, but people's feelings do get hurt. Samantha Schreiber, the one with all those bachelorette t-shirts under her bed, says these kinds of events can become a test of the friendship.
Like, you're testing how close I am to you by whether or not I'm, like, willing to take off time from work and come to Vegas and pay, like, $20 for, like, one drink that's well cocktails. Like, oh, my God. It's not avocado toast that's, like, the reason I can't buy a house, you know?
Schreiber happens to be planning her own wedding, and she's thinking about what she's going to ask of her friends. On the one hand, she doesn't want to put them through all this. But a bachelorette party in Mexico could be fun. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today. Not only are we getting into wedding season, as Mariel was just saying, summer travel season is well nigh upon us with Memorial Day on Monday. And so this... According to Airlines for America, that's the trade group for the big airlines in this country, a record 257 million people are going to be on your plane between June the 1st and the end of August. All right, that's all planes, not just yours, but you know what I mean. Those are the numbers. Here is the spin from the group's chief economist. Remember, it's the airline industry's lobbying group. Quote, with airlines offering low fares and reinvesting billions of dollars in their product, he said, there has never been a better time to fly. Mm-hmm. All right, we're out of here. The Dow, rather, up 95 points today, 0.3%. The NASDAQ up 8 points, about 0.1%. S&P 500 gained 3, also about 0.1%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have a great weekend, everybody. We will be here on Monday. If you're working, thank you. If you're not, take a second. Think about what the day means, all right? We'll see you then. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.